grinned and pressed herself against him. "Fuck reality, baby! Let's go save the universe!"
"I will prepare the spell to send you back," Penny said.
It was snowing harder, the flakes blowing slantwise through their little dome of warmth, but Quentin felt invulnerable now. They were going to fight this, and they were going to win. Penny began chanting in that same incomprehensible language he'd used before. It had some vowel sounds that Quentin barely recognized as human.
"It needs a minute to take effect," he said when he was done. "Of course, from this point forward, the journey will be undertaken by members of the Order."
"Wait. What do you mean?"
"My colleagues and I will return with you to your ship and carry out the remainder of the quest. You may observe, of course."
Penny gave them a moment to take that in.
"You didn't think we would leave a mission of this importance to a group of amateurs, did you? We appreciate the good work you've done to get us this far. We truly do. But it's out of your hands now. It's time for the professionals to take over."
"Sorry, but no," Quentin said. "It isn't." He wasn't giving this up. And he definitely wasn't inviting Penny along.
"I suppose you'll find your own way back to Fillory, then," Penny said. He crossed his handless arms. "I take back the spell."
"You can't take it back," Poppy said. "What are you, 9? Penny!"
He'd finally gotten under even Poppy's skin.
"You don't understand," Quentin said, though he wasn't totally sure he understood himself. "This is our job. Nobody else can do it for us. That's not how it works. You have to send us back."
"I have to. Are you going to make me?"
"Jesus, Penny, you are unbelievable. Literally, unbelievable. You know, I actually thought you'd changed. I really did. Do you even get that this isn't about you?"
"Not about me?"
Penny lost his grip on his interdimensional monk voice again and spoke in his old, higher-pitched voice, the one he used to use when he felt especially aggrieved and self-righteous.
"Spare me that, Quentin. You haven't spared me much during our long acquaintance, but spare me that. I found the Netherlands. I found the button. I took us to Fillory. You didn't do all that, Quentin. I did. And I got my hands bitten off by the beast, and I came here, and now I'm going to finish this because I started it."
Quentin imagined it. Penny and his fellow Blue Oyster Cult members showing up on the Muntjac and ordering everybody, ordering Elliot, around. Probably they were better magicians than he was, technically, but still, no, he couldn't do it. It was impossible. They glared at each other. It was a stalemate.
"Penny, can I ask you something?" Quentin said.
"How do you do magic now? I mean, without your hands?" The funny thing about Penny was that you knew questions like that weren't going to make him uncomfortable, and it didn't.
In fact, his mood brightened immediately.
"At first I thought I would never do magic again," Penny explained. "But when the Order took me in, they taught me another technique that does not depend on hand motions. Think about it. What's special about hands? What if you were to use other muscles in your body to cast spells? The Order showed me how. Now I can see how limiting it was. To be honest, I'm a little surprised you're still doing it the old way."
Penny wiped his chin with his sleeve. He always used to spit a little when he got excited. Quentin took a deep breath. "Penny, I don't think you or the Order can finish this quest. I'm sorry. Ember assigned this one to us, and he must have had his reasons.
I think that may just be the way it works. It's his will. I don't think it would work for anybody else."
Penny mulled this for a minute.
"All right," he said finally. "All right. I can see there is a certain logic to it, and there is a great deal for the Order to do in the Netherlands. In fact, in many respects, the crucial effort will take place here while you retrieve the keys."
Quentin had a feeling that was the best he was going to get. "Great. I appreciate that. If you wanted to, you could take this opportunity to say that you're sorry about sleeping with my girlfriend."
You were on a break.
Okay, look. Just get us the hell out of here. We have to go save Magic.
If they stayed here any longer, Quentin was going to doom the universe all over again by killing Penny with his bare hands, though it would almost be worth it. What are you going to do while we do that?
We, the Order and I, are going to engage the gods directly. This will delay them while you recover the last key.
But what could you possibly do?
Poppy asked.
Aren't they all powerful, or practically?
Oh, the Order can do things you wouldn't believe. We've spent millennia studying in the Library of the Netherlands. We know secrets that you never dreamed of. We know secrets that would drive you mad if I whispered them to you. And we're not alone. We'll have help.
A deep, muffled thump filled the square from over by the fountain that led back to Earth. It shook the air. They felt it in their knees. A stone fell somewhere. Another thump followed it, and another, as if something was knocking, trying to force its way into the world from somewhere underneath it. Was it the gods? Maybe they were too late. There was a final thump, and all at once the ice in the fountain exploded upward. Quentin and Poppy ducked as chunks of it shot in all directions and went skittering across the paving stones. With a metallic groan, the great bronze lotus flower tore open, the petals spreading out in all directions as if it were blooming, and a huge, sinuous form came surging and wriggling up out of it. The thing lunged violently up into the air, spreading its wings and shaking off water and beating its way into the night sky, whipping the falling snow into great whorls and circles around it. Another one followed it, and then a third.
"It's the dragons!"
Poppy shouted. She clapped her hands like a little girl.
"Quentin, it's the dragons! Oh, look at them!"
"It's the dragons," Penny said. "The dragons are going to help us."
Poppy kissed him on the cheek, and Penny smiled for the first time. You could tell he didn't want to, but he couldn't help himself. The dragons kept coming, one after the other. They must have emptied out every river in the world. The square lit up as one of them roared a gout of flame at the misty sky. How did he know that was going to happen right then? "You planned that, didn't you?" Quentin said, or tried to say. But just then, Penny's spell took effect, and Quentin was no longer in the same world as the person he was talking to.
Book 4 Chapter 23
That morning in Mur, sitting around the table in the library, they gave Julia the full download. In a way, she was lucky she was only getting in now. She'd missed the early days, when they spent a lot of time just ruling things out. For example, they'd blown 6 months on a theory that spells picked up extra power the closer you got to the center of the Earth. A minor effect, barely measurable, but if it could be verified, it would open up huge, ripe fields of new theory. It would change everything. That had kicked off a barnstorming tour of abandoned mines and salt domes and other deep subterranean topography, not excluding an expensive sequence involving a rented tramp steamer and a second-hand bathysphere. But all they'd learned from half a year's hard spelunking and deep ocean diving was that Asmodeus's spell work performed slightly better once you got half a mile underground, and that the most probable explanation for that was that spelunking got Asmodeus really excited. They pushed on into astrology and ocean magic, and even oniromancy, dream magic. Turns out you can cast some truly amazing shit in your dreams. But after you wake up, it all seems kind of pointless, and nobody really wants to hear about it. They worked with Earth's magnetic field, using apparatus cribbed from Nikola Tesla drawings, right up until the night when Failstaff almost flipped the planet's magnetic poles, whereupon they dropped the whole line of investigation and backed away slowly. Gummidge spent a sleepless week developing a witheringly abstract hypothesis related to cosmic rays and quantum effects and the Higgs boson, which in the end even she only half understood.
She swore she could prove it mathematically, but the calculations required were so involved that they would have required a computer the size of the universe running for a length of time that would have taken them past the projected heat death of the universe to work them out. It was pretty much the definition of moot. That's when they turned to religion. At this, Julia pushed her chair back from the table. She could feel her intellectual gag reflex about to kick in.
"I know,"
Pouncey said, "but it's not what you think. Hear us out." Falstaff began unrolling a huge, closely annotated diagram that was almost as big as the table. Religion had never been a subject that interested Julia. She considered herself too smart to believe in things she had no evidence for, and that behaved in ways that violated every principle she'd ever observed or heard plausibly spoken about. And she considered herself too tough-minded to believe in things just because they made her feel better. Magic was one thing. With magic, you were at least looking at reproducible results. But religion? That was about faith, uneducated guesses made by weak minds. As far as she knew, or thought she knew, her views on this matter were shared by the other free traders. "There was a piece missing," Pouncey went on. "We thought we'd gone back to first principles. But what if we hadn't? What if there were principles before the first principles we'd gone back to? We were assuming, until it could be proved otherwise, that there were bigger energies out there, far bigger, and that there was a technique by which those energies could be manipulated. Humans have not, so far as we know, in the modern era, gained access to those energies. But suppose there were another class of beings who did have access to them. Maybe not humans." "Another class of beings," Julia said flatly. "You're talking about God." "Gods. I wanted to find out more about them."
"That's insane. There's no such thing as gods, or God. You know, Pouncey, one of the things I love about the fact that I didn't go to college is that I didn't have to sit around a freshman dorm getting high and arguing about shit like this." But Pouncey was not withered by her scorn. "Once you've eliminated the possible, whatever remains, however impossible, must be the truth." Sherlock Holmes. "That's not actually the quote. And it doesn't mean that gods are real, Pouncey. It means you need to go back and check your work because you screwed it up somewhere."
"We checked it."
"Then maybe you should give up," Julia said.
"But I don't give up," Pouncey said. His eyes had a wintry, sleety gray to them that was distinctly un-Abercrombie and Fitch. "And neither do they." He indicated the others sitting around the table. "And neither do you. Do you, Julia?"
Julia blinked and held his gaze to indicate that she would keep listening, but that she made no promises. Pouncey went on.
"We're not talking about monotheism, or at least not in its latter-day form. We're talking about old-time religion, paganism, or, more precisely, polytheism. Forget everything you ordinarily associate with religious study. Strip away all the reverence and the awe and the art and the philosophy of it. Treat the subject coldly. Imagine yourself to be a theologist, but a special kind of theologist, one who studies gods the way an entomologist studies insects. Take as your data set the entirety of world mythology and treat it as a collection of field observations and statistics pertaining to a hypothetical species. The god. Proceed from there."
Fastidiously at first, with rubber gloves and tweezers and haughty distaste, as if they were handling the intellectual equivalent of medical waste, Pouncey and the others took up the study of comparative religion. Much as Julia had done with magic back in her apartment above the bagel store, they began combing the world's religious narratives and traditions for practical information. They called it Project Ganymede.
"What the hell were you hoping to find?" Julia said.
"I wanted to learn their techniques. I wanted to be able to do what gods did. I don't see any real distinction between religion and magic, or for that matter, between gods and magicians. I think divine power is just another form of magical praxis. You know what Arthur C. Clarke said about technology and magic, right? Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Turn it around. What is advanced magic indistinguishable from? Any sufficiently advanced magic is indistinguishable from the miraculous.
The fire of the gods, Falstaff rumbled. Jesus, he was a true believer too.
But despite herself, and she took care not to show it, Julia felt her curiosity stirring. She reminded herself that she knew these people well.
They were as smart as she was, and they were at least as big intellectual snobs as she was.
She probably wasn't going to come up with a lot of objections that they hadn't already thought of.
"Look, Pouncey," she said, "I know enough about religion to know that even if there are gods, they don't exactly hand out holy fire like candy.
There's only one way this story ends. It's Prometheus all over again. Phaeton, Icarus, pick your sucker. You fly too close to the sun, the thermal energy from the sun overwhelms the weak attractive forces that allow the wax in your wings to maintain its solid form, and down you go, into the sea. No fire for you. And that's if you're lucky. If you're unlucky, you end up like Prometheus. Birds eat your liver forever."
"Usually," Falstaff said, "there are exceptions."
"For example, not everybody is such a complete dink that they make their wings out of wax," Asmodeus said.
Briskly, Falstaff walked Julia through the enormous diagram on the table in front of them, sketching arcs and connections with his thick, soft fingers. The diagram showed the primary narratives of the major and minor religious traditions, collated and cross-referenced and color-coded, to highlight areas where they overlapped and confirmed one another. Apparently, if you're enough of a power nerd, there is nothing that cannot be flowcharted.
"The hubristic scenario, the pride that challenges the gods and leads to the death of the challenger, is only one of a number of possible scenarios, and usually the bad outcome can be traced to poor preparation on the part of the principals. It does not at all imply that it is categorically impossible for a mortal to gain access to divine power."
"Hmm," Julia said, "theoretically."
"No, not theoretically," Asmodeus said sharply. "Practically, historically, technically, the process is called ascension, or sometimes assumption, or my favorite word for it is translation. They all mean the same thing, the process by which a human being is brought bodily into heaven without dying and accorded some measure of divine status. And then there's apotheosis, which is related, whereby a human actually becomes a god. It's been done tons of times."
"Give me examples."
"Mary,"
she ticked off a finger, "as in Jesus's mom, she was born mortal and ended up divine.
Galahad, Arthurian legend, he was Lancelot's son. He found the Holy Grail and was taken directly up into heaven. So was Enoch. He was an early descendant of Adam's."
"There's a couple of Chinese generals," Gummidgee said. "Guan Yu, Fan Kuai. There's the eight immortals of Taoism."
"Dido, Buddha, Simon Magus," Pouncey chimed in. "It just goes on and on."
"Or look at Ganymede," Asmo said. "Greek legend, he was immortal, but of such great beauty that Zeus brought him up to Olympus to be a cupbearer, hence the project name."
"We think cupbearer was probably a euphemism," Falstaff added.
"No kidding," Julia said. "Okay, I get the point. Not everybody ends up like Icarus, but these are just stories. There's immortals in Highlander, but that doesn't mean they're real."
"Those aren't gods," Falstaff said. "Jesus, haven't you seen the movie?"
"And these aren't just ordinary mortals you're talking about. They were all special in some way. Like you said, Enoch was a descendant of Adam."
"And you're not," Asmo said.
"Galahad was inhumanly virtuous. Ganymede was inhumanly beautiful, which I don't think anybody here exactly qualifies for either. You all seem pretty human to me."
"Very true," Pouncey said. "Very true. It's an issue. Listen, for the moment, we're talking proof of concept. We're in initial trials. We're nowhere near drawing definitive conclusions yet. We just don't want to rule anything out.
Like a professor showing around a prospective graduate student, Pouncey took Julia on a tour of the parts of the East Wing she hadn't been allowed into before. She passed room after room stuffed with the paraphernalia of 100 churches and temples. There were raiments and vestments. There were altars and torches and censers and mitres. There were 1,000 flavors of incense. She picked up a bundle of sacred staffs tied together with twine. She recognized a bishop's crozier among them and a druidical shillelagh. This was a different class of hardware from what she was used to handling, to say the least. It looked like rubbish to her. But who could tell for sure without testing? Maybe this was the industrial strength stuff. Maybe this really was the big iron, the magical equivalent of the Large Hadron Collider. You couldn't rule it out till you'd ruled it out, could you? So Julia joined Project Ganymede. She pitched in with the others. Doing what nerds do, she sliced and diced, organized and spreadsheeted, drew up checklists, and then checked the hell out of them. The magicians of Mur chanted, drank, sacrificed, fasted, bathed, painted their faces, consulted the stars, and huffed odd gases from bubbling liquids. It was hard to assimilate the sight of the solemn, gawky Gummidgee ululating and tripping on peyote, topless and in full face paint, but as Pouncey pointed out, in the context of their present field of study, this was what rigor looked like. Asmodeus swore in hushed tones, glittering with suppressed merriment, that Pouncey and Gummidgee were running Bacchic sex rituals on the sly, but if she had proof, she declined to make it available to Julia. They had to find out if there was a magical technique behind all this messy crap, and if there was, who knew, maybe it would make the stuff in the three-ring binders look like bar mitzvah magic. At the point when Julia joined Project Ganymede, Pouncey didn't have much to show by way of results, but he'd seen enough to keep hoping that it wasn't a complete waste of time, all red herring and no white whale. Apparently Iris had been trying a new transcription of a Sumerian chant the other night, when something like a swarm of insects issued, no other word really applied, from her mouth. It hovered in the middle of the room for a second, buzzing fiercely, and then broke a window and disappeared outside. Iris couldn't speak for 2 days afterward. The thing had scorched her throat coming out. There were other hints, too, scattered manifestations of something nobody even had a theory as to what. Objects moving by themselves, glasses and pots shattering. There were those phantom giant footsteps that had woken Julia up. Fiberpunk, the fireplug metamagician, had fasted and meditated for 3 days, and on the morning of the fourth, he swore he'd seen a hand in a ray of sunshine, felt it reach down and gently touch his pudgy face with its hot fingers. But nobody else could make it happen. That's what was frustrating. Magic wasn't a perfect linear grid or anything, but compared with magic, religion was just chaos, a complete junk pile. Sure, it was plenty ritualized and formalized and codified, but the rituals didn't deliver consistent, reproducible results. The thing about real magic was once you learned a spell and you cast it properly, and you weren't too tired and the circumstances hadn't shifted while you weren't looking, then it worked, generally speaking. But this religious stuff didn't give good data. Pouncey was convinced that if they could drill down far enough, parse the underlying grammar, they'd have the basis for an entirely new and radically more powerful magical technique. But the further down they drilled, the more chaotic and less grammatical it got. Sometimes it felt like there was some capricious, mischievous presence on the other side that was pressing buttons and pulling levers at random just to piss them off. Pouncey had the patience for it, to sit and wait out the noisy data until the patterns emerged. But Pouncey was a singular individual. So while he and his acolytes pored over sacred texts and filled hard drive after hard drive with chaotic pseudo-data, Asmodeus took a smaller group out into the field in search of a shortcut.
she went looking for a live specimen. Pouncey wasn't thrilled to find Asmo leading a splinter movement, but she stood up to him with the icy firmness of a 17-year-old corporate vice president. There was, she explained, although everybody already knew, a population of magical beings on Earth. It was a modest population, as Earth wasn't an especially hospitable environment for them. Magically speaking, the soil was rocky and bitter, the air thin, the winters harsh. Life on Earth for a fairy was analogous to life in the Arctic for a human. They survived, but they did not thrive. And yet some few remained, the Inuits, by analogy, of the magical world. Among those few, there was a hierarchy. Some were more powerful, some less so. At the bottom were the vampires, seedy serial killers from whose population the non-sociopaths had been bred hundreds of generations ago by natural selection. Empathy was not a survival trait among the Strigoi. They were not well-liked. But above them were any number of orders of fairies and elementals and lycanthropes and one-off oddities leading up the power chain. And this was where Asmodeus saw her opportunity. If she worked her way up the ladder, patiently, rung by rung, who knows where she might get? She might not get all the way to gods, but she might meet somebody who knew somebody who had the gods' fax number. It beat fasting. To begin with, they kept things local, day trips to hot spots within easy striking distance. Enough of Provence was still farmland and parkland that they could still ferret out indigenous sprites, minor river sirens, even the odd wyvern without much trouble. But that was small fry. As July turned to August and the hills around Mur lit up with lavender fields, so idyllically beautiful they looked like something you'd see on a calendar in a dentist's office, Asmodeus and her hand-picked team, which now included Falstaff as well, disappeared into the field for days at a time. Their efforts were not, at first, conspicuously successful. Asmo would knock on Julia's door at 3 a.m, dead leaves in her hair and holding a 2/3 full bottle of Prosecco, and they would sit on Julia's bed while Asmo described a night of fruitless bullshitting in old Provençal with a bunch of lutins, basically the French equivalent of your modern leprechaun, who kept trying to crawl up under her, admittedly invitingly short, skirt. But there was progress. Falstaff kept a special room, neatly swept, with a white tablecloth set with fresh food as a kind of honey pot for local spirits called fedas, who would come bearing good luck in their right hands, bad in their left. Asmo woke her up crowing about having gotten an audience with the golden goat, a being usually seen only by shepherds, and from a distance. It wasn't all good luck and golden goats. One night Asmo came back with wet hair, shivering in the early autumn chill, after a drac, in the middle of an otherwise perfectly civil interview, had abruptly pulled her right into the Rhone. The next day she saw the thing in the supermarket in the shape of a man, stocking its shopping cart with jars of anchovies. It winked at her merrily. Plus, somebody was stealing their hubcaps. Asmo thought it must be a local trickster deity called Reynard the Fox. He was supposed to be some kind of anti-gentry, anti-clerical hero of the peasantry, but she just considered him a pain in the ass. One morning, Julia saw Falstaff at breakfast looking as grim as she'd ever seen him. Over espresso and muesli, he swore to her that he'd seen a black horse with a back as long as a school bus, with 30 crying children mounted on it, match speeds with them last night as they drove home in the van. It paced them for 2 solid minutes, sometimes trotting on the ground, sometimes galloping along up on power lines or across the treetops. Then it leaped straight into a river, kids and all. They stopped and waited, but it never came back up. Real or illusion? They searched the papers for stories about missing kids, but they never found anything. Most days the two groups would debrief at noon over lunch for Pouncey's team and breakfast for Asmo's, who were out all night in the field most nights and got up late. Each side presented its data, and each side would feed what the other side had learned back into the next stage of its investigations. There was a certain amount of healthy competition between the two sides. Also some unhealthy competition.
"For fuck's sake, Asmo," Pouncey said one day in September, interrupting her mid-report.
The hayfields all around the house were turning a toasted brown. "How is this getting us anywhere? If I have to hear one more word about that golden fucking goat, I'm going to go mental."
"Absolutely mental. The goat knows nothing. This whole region is just chicken shit. I would kill for something Greek. Anything. God, demigod, spirit, monster, I don't even care what. A cyclops. There's got to be a few of those things left. We're practically on the Mediterranean."
Asmodeus stared at him balefully across a table strewn with baguette crusts and smears of local jam. Her eyes looked hollow. She was wiped out from lack of sleep. A huge wasp, its legs dangling limply, airlifted from one jam smear to the next.
"No cyclops," she said. "Sirens, I could get you a siren."
"Sirens?"
Pouncey brightened up. He banged the table with the flat of his hand.
"Why didn't you say so? That's great."
"They're not Greek sirens, though. They're French. They're half snake from the waist down."
Pouncey frowned.
"So like a gorgon."
"No, gorgons have snakes for hair. Except anyway, I don't think gorgons are real."
"A half-snake woman," Julia said, "would be a lamia."
"She would be," Asmodeus snapped, "if she were in Greece, but we're in France, so she's a siren."
"All right, but maybe she knows a lamia," Pouncey said. "Maybe they're related, like cousins. You gotta think all the snake-bodied women have a network."
"She doesn't know a lamia,"
Asmodeus put her head down on the table.
"God, you have no idea what you're asking."
"I'm not asking you, I'm telling you. You've got to widen your search. I'm so sick of this cutesy Frenchy-French shit. Ever wonder why Clash of the Lutons was never a movie? The power levels around here are nothing.
We can fly you to Greece. The money isn't a problem. We can all go to Greece. But you've hit a wall here and you're too stubborn to admit it."
"You don't know!"
Asmodeus sat up, her red eyes flaming.
"You don't understand what I'm doing! You can't just go knocking on doors like you're taking a census. You have to build up trust. I'm running a network of agents here now. Some of these things haven't talked to a human for centuries. The golden goat..."
"God!"
He stuck a finger in Asmodeus's face.
"No more with the goat!"
"Asmo's right, Pouncey."
All eyes turned to Julia. She could see that Pouncey had expected her to back him up. Well, she wasn't here to play power games. If there's one thing magic had taught her, it was that power wasn't a game.
"You're thinking about this the wrong way. The answer isn't wider, it's deeper. If we start hopping around the globe cherry-picking myths and legends, we're going to burn through all our time and money and end up with nothing."
"Well, so far we've got golden fucking goat cheese."
"Hey now," Falstaff said. "That stuff was perfectly edible."
"You're missing the point. If we go out there looking for something specific, we'll never find anything. But if we focus on some place rich and really deep dive it, work our way down through what's there, we're bound to hit something solid eventually. If there's anything solid to hit.
Some place rich, like Greece. It's like I was saying,
we don't need to go to Greece," Julia said. "We don't need to go anywhere. All this stuff has to be connected at the roots. Everybody came through Provence. The Celts were here, the Romans, the Basques. The Buddhists sent missionaries. The Egyptians had colonies. And so did the Greeks, Pouncey, if you absolutely need the Greeks to get you hard. They even had Jews. Sure, it all got covered over with Christianity, but the mythology goes all the way down. If we can't find a god in all that, there are no gods to be found."
"So what are you saying?" Pouncey regarded her skeptically, not pleased by her display of disloyalty. "We should drop all the world religion stuff and just do local folk and myth?"
"That's what I'm saying. That's where our sources are. Let's bear down on those and see what they get us."
Pouncey pursed his lips, considering. Everyone looked at him.
All right. He threw up his hands. All right, fine. Let's do a month just on Provençal stuff and see what it gets us. He glared around the table. But no more dicking around with leprechauns. Take us up the food chain, Asmo. I want to know who runs this area. Find out who all these small players are afraid of and then get that guy's number. That's who we want to talk to. Asmodeus heaved a sigh. She looked years older than she had in June.
I'll try, she said. I really will, Pouncey, but you don't know what you're asking.
You'd never hear Pouncey cop to it, but Julia turned out to be right. When they narrowed their focus to the local mythology only, Project Ganymede began to get traction. Once they started looking at just one corner of the puzzle and stuck all the rest of the pieces back in the box, everything started to fit together. Poring through Gregory of Tours and other nameless medieval chroniclers, Julia began to get a feel for the local magic. Like wine, Provençal magic had its own distinctive terroir. It was rich and chaotic and romantic. It was night magic, confabulated out of moons and silver, wine and blood, knights and fairies, wind and rivers and forests. It concerned itself with good and evil, but also with the vast intermediate realm in between, the realm of mischief. It was also mother magic. Gradually, Julia began to become aware of something or someone who was standing behind the old dead pages, just out of view. Julia couldn't see her or name her, or not yet, but she felt her. She must have been old. Very old. She must have gotten here early, long before the Romans. Nothing Julia read spoke of her directly. You couldn't look straight at her, but you knew she was there because of the small ways she perturbed the universe around her. Julia picked up on her only by triangulation, via tiny traces, little glimpses, like the curious black Madonna figures you saw scattered around Europe, and especially around Provence. Black Madonnas were otherwise ordinary images of the Virgin Mary, but with an inexplicably dark complexion. But she was older than the Virgin Mary, and wilder. Julia thought she must be some kind of local fertility goddess from out of the darkness of the region's deep, pre-literate past, before the cosmopolitan conquerors came in and scraped everything smooth and clean and paved it over with official homogenizing Christianity. A distant cousin of Diana, or Cybele, or Isis, ethnographically speaking. When the Christians arrived, they would have lumped her in with Mary, but Julia thought she might still be out there, on her own. She sensed the goddess looking out from behind the mask of Christian dogma, the way the second Julia had looked out from behind the mask of the first Julia. The goddess called to Julia. Julia, who had turned her back on her own mother to save herself, and now heard about her only in oblique and infrequent emails from her sister, sent from the safe bosom of a small top-flight liberal arts college in western Massachusetts. Julia remembered the grace and forgiveness with which she had been received back into her home when she came crawling back from Chesterton. It was like nothing else she had ever experienced before or since. It was the closest to the divine she'd ever been. The more Julia read and cross-checked and deduced and collated, the more she was convinced her goddess was real. Nothing she longed for that ardently could fail to exist. It was like the goddess was just on the other side of all these useless words, trying to find Julia as Julia was searching for her. She wasn't a great and grand world-ruling goddess, a Hera or Frigga. She was more of a middleweight, a team player on a big pantheon. She wasn't a grain goddess like Ceres. Provence was rocky and Mediterranean, not wheat country at all. Julia's goddess dealt in grapes and olives, the dark, intense fruit of hard, gnarled trees and vines. And she had daughters, too, the dryads, ferocious defenders of the forests. The goddess was warm, even humorous and loving, but she had a second aspect, terrible in its bleakness, a mourning aspect that she assumed in winter
when she descended to the underworld, away from the light. There were different versions of the story. In some, she grew angry at mankind and hid herself underground half the year out of rage. In some, she lost one of her dryad daughters and retired to Hades in grief. In others, the goddess was fooled by some Loki-type trickster god and bound to spend half the year hiding her warmth and fruitfulness in the underworld against her will. But in each version, her dual nature was clear. She was a goddess of darkness as well as light, a black Madonna, the blackness of death, but also the blackness of good soil, dark with decay, which gives rise to life. Julia wasn't the only one to hear the call of the goddess. The others talked about her, too. The free trader Beowulf alumni in particular, who tended not to have been the beneficiaries of world-class mothering as children, felt drawn to her. In the crypt under Chartres Cathedral, there was an ancient druidical well, and nearby a famous statue of the Black Madonna that was known as Notre-Dame sous terre. So that's what they called the goddess, for lack of a real name, Our Lady Underground, or sometimes, when they were being familiar, just OLU. Esmo began to take Julia out on some of the nighttime raids. These were conducted in Julia's former rental Peugeot, or in the event that they were considering extracting and transporting someone or something, a long-suffering Renault traffic van. One night, they followed a tip deep into the Camargue, the vast, swampy delta of the Rhone River, where it flowed into the Mediterranean, 300 square miles of salt marshes and lagoons. It was a 2-hour drive. The Camargue was, allegedly, home to a creature called the Tarasque. When Julia asked Asmodeus for details, she just said, "You wouldn't believe me if I told you." She was right. Having squelched through miles of rotten, boot-sucking ground, they finally tracked the thing down and chivied it out of its hiding place in a hollow full of stunted, broken marsh pines. It faced them in the moonlight, making a miserable, whuffling sound like it had a nagging cold.
"What?" Julia said. "The fuck?"
"Holy shit," said Falstaff.
"This is exceeding expectations," Asmo said. The Tarasque was a beast about the size of a hippo, but with 6 legs. It had a scorpion tail, a kind of lion-human head with stringy long hair, and on its back a turtle shell with spikes coming out of it. It was the turtle shell that did it. It looked like Bowser from Super Mario Brothers. The Tarasque crouched low to the ground, wheezing, its chin resting on a wet stump, looking up at them with its unbelievably ugly face. Its posture was not so much defensive as resigned.
"Leave it to the French to come up with the most fucked-upest dragon ever," Asmodeus sighed.
Once the Tarasque realized they weren't going to attack it, it began to talk. In fact, they couldn't get it to shut up. The thing didn't need a roving strike team of folklorist wizards. It needed a therapist. They sat there all night on tree stumps, listening to it complain about how lonely and insufficiently damp it was. Not till dawn did it lumber back into its hollow. But the Tarasque turned out to be worth it. It was a champion whiner, and if they were trying to figure out who people around here were afraid of, well, it was afraid of practically everyone. They were spoiled for choice. The Tarasque was too big for the small fry to pick on, but reading between the lines, it was clear that it was a whipping boy for the upper ranks of mythological society. Apparently, Reynard the Fox teased it a great deal, though it begged them not to mention anything about that to Reynard for fear of reprisals. More interestingly, the Tarasque was subjected to periodic beatings by a holy man of some kind, who had been haunting the slopes of Mount Ventoux for the past millennium or so. It was the Tarrasque's terrifying appearance, see, that caused it to be so often misunderstood. A being of such ferocious magnificence as itself was too often assumed to be evil, and scourged and vilified should it devour even so much as 6 or 7 village folk. That was why it had taken to spending its days wallowing in the salt bogs of the Camargue, nomming the occasional wild horse to stay alive. Why not join it? It was cool and safe here, and you know, it so rarely found anyone nice to talk to, not like that nasty holy man. They were so much nicer than he was.
Driving back along empty pre-dawn highways, squinting out at the flatness of the swamp through gummy eyes, they all agreed that the holy hermit sounded like a very nasty customer indeed. Exactly the kind of nasty customer they should get to know better. A new atmosphere had settled over the house at Mur. It had always been a basic tenet there that luxury and comfort were integral parts of the magical lifestyle, not just for its own sake, but as a matter of principle. As magicians, Mur magicians, they were the secret aristocracy of the world, and goddammit, they were going to live like it. Now that was changing. Nobody said anything, and certainly no edicts came down from Pouncey, but the atmosphere became more Spartan. The serious nature of their investigation was cooling and tempering their collective mood. Less wine came out with dinner, and sometimes none at all. The food became plainer. Conversations were conducted in hushed tones, as they would be in the halls of a monastery. An attitude of seriousness and austerity was taking root among them. Julia suspected some of the others of fasting. From a high-energy magical research center, Mur was turning into something more like a religious retreat. Julia felt it too. She began getting up at dawn. She spoke only when necessary. Her mind was clear and sharp, her thoughts like birds calling to one another in an empty sky. At night she slept heavily, deep ocean sleep. Calm and dark, adrift with strange, silent, luminous creatures. One night she dreamed that Our Lady Underground visited her in her room. She came in the form of a statue of herself, the one from the crypt at Chartres, stiff and cold. The statue gave Julia a wooden cup. Sitting up, Julia lifted it to her lips and drank like a feverish child being given medicine in bed. The liquid was cool and sweet, and she thought of the Dunn poem about the thirsty earth. Then she lowered the cup, and the goddess leaned down and kissed her, with her hard, gilded icon's face. Then the statue broke apart, its outside crumbling like an eggshell, and from inside it stepped the true goddess, clear at last. She was grave and unbearably lovely, and she held her attributes in either hand, a gnarled olive staff in her right, a bird's nest with 3 eggs in it in her left. Half of her face was in shadow for the half of the year she spent underground. Her eyes were full of love and forgiveness.
"You are my daughter," she said, "my true daughter. I will come for you."
Julia woke to the sound of Pouncey pounding on her door.
"Come look," he whispered when she opened it. "You have to see this."
Still drowsy in her nightgown, Julia followed him through the darkened house. She felt as if she were still dreaming. The floor creaked loudly, as it always did when one tried to creep through a house by night. They padded down stone steps to a basement room reserved for high-impact experiments. Pouncey practically ran ahead of her. The lights were off. A single coherent shaft of moonlight entered the room through a high window, which was at ground level outside. She rubbed the sleep out of her eyes.
"Okay," Pouncey said, "before we lose the light."
There was a table in the room with a white tablecloth and a small round mirror on it. Pouncey drew a sigil on it 3 times with his finger.
"Hold out your hands, like this."
He cupped his hands. When Julia cupped hers, he held the mirror so that it reflected the moonbeam into them. She gasped. Immediately she felt her hands fill with something cold and hard. Coins.
They made a sound like rain.
They're silver, Pouncey said. I think they're real.
One of the coins jingled on the floor and rolled away.
This was powerful magic. It felt like nothing else she'd ever seen.
Let me try, she whispered.
She copied the sign he'd made on the mirror. This time, instead of silver, the moonbeam became something white and liquid. It pooled on the table, soaking into the cloth. She touched a finger to it and tasted it.
Milk.
How did you do this? She said.
I'm not sure, Pouncey said. But I think I prayed.
Oh, God. She forced down a hysterical giggle.
Who did you pray to?
I found it in one of these old Provençal books, Languedoc stuff. The language looked like an incantation, but I was wondering why there were no gestures to go with it. So I just got on my knees and clasped my hands and said the words.
Pouncey flushed.
I thought about OLU.
Let's have a look under the hood.
There were simple spells to make magic visible. They showed you the ways the energy was running in and around an object with an enchantment on it. But what Julia saw when she cast one on the mirror defied explanation. It was the densest weave of magic she'd ever seen, a tracery of fine lines in an ornate pattern like a tapestry, so dense that it almost obscured the mirror underneath it. It should have taken a team of magicians a year at least to put all those channels in place. Instead, Pouncey had done it alone, in one night, with a simple chant. It was unlike any working she'd ever heard of.
You did this? Just now?
I don't know, he said. I don't think so. I said the words, but I think somebody else must have done the work.
Her hands and her body felt strangely light. There was a sweet smell in the air. Acting on an impulse, she dabbed a little of the milk on each of her eyelids. Instantly, her vision sharpened and clarified, like when they changed the settings at the ophthalmologist's.
We're getting close, Julia, Pouncey said. We're getting close to the divine praxis. I can feel it.
I don't like feeling things, she said. I like knowing them.
But she had to admit she felt it too. The only word she could think of to describe this magic was grave. There was nothing light or playful about it. It was dead fucking sober magic, serious as a heart attack. Where was the line between a spell and a miracle? Turning moonlight into silver coins wasn't exactly parting the Red Sea, but the effortlessness with which it was accomplished spoke of much larger possibilities. It was a minor effect running off an enormous power source. The next morning, Asmodeus was at breakfast. Real breakfast, not her usual lunch breakfast. She was practically vibrating with excitement. She refused any food.
I found him, she said with finality.
Who?
Julia said. It was a little early for Asmodeus in her maximum intensity mode.
Whom did you find?
The hermit. The Tarasque's holy man. He's a saint. Or not a saint, exactly. Not in the strictly Christian sense, but he calls himself one.
Explain, Pouncey said around a hunk of the almost penitentially coarse bread they'd been eating. Well, and here Asmodeus shook off her manic fatigue for a minute and entered her business mode. As close as I can figure out, this guy is about 2,000 years old, right? He calls himself Amadur. Says he used to be a saint, but they defrocked him. I found him living in a cave, red hair, beard down to here. Says he serves the goddess, the old one, the one we're always hearing about. He wouldn't name her, but it has to be her, Our Lady, OLU. For a while, he passed as a Christian saint, he told me, saying he worshipped the Virgin Mary, but eventually he got outed as a pagan, and they tried to crucify him. He's been living in a cave ever since. And at first I was all sure, buddy, saint or crazy homeless guy, it's a fine line. But he showed me things, weird things, guys, things we don't know how to do. He can shape rock with his hands. He heals animals. He knew things about me, things nobody knows. He He healed a scar I have. Had. He made it go away.
Her voice faltered. Julia had never seen Asmodeus look so serious. She glared at them, angry that she'd let a secret slip. Julia had never seen Asmodeus's scar. She wondered if she meant a physical one or something else.
"Can you take us to him?"
Pouncey's voice was gentle. He seemed to sense how close to the edge she was. She shook her head quickly, trying to recover herself and not succeeding.
"You only see him once," she said. "You could go find him yourself, maybe, but I can't tell you where the cave was. I mean, I remember, but I can't tell you. Literally, I tried just now."
She shrugged helplessly.
"Nothing comes out."
They all looked at each other over the cold crusts and dead coffee.
"I almost forgot," she said. "He gave me something."
She unzipped her backpack and rummaged in it for a sheet of parchment, closely written.
"It's a palimpsest. Can you believe it? So old school. I watched him scrape the ink off some priceless ancient hymnal or something to make it. Probably a Dead Sea Scroll or something. He wrote out how to call on the goddess, Our Lady Underground."
Pouncey took the paper from her. His fingers shook slightly.
"An invocation," he said.
"So that's it, then," Julia said. "The lady's phone number."
"That's it. It's in Phoenician, I think, if you can believe it. He didn't know if she'd come, but..."
Asmo picked up the heel of Pouncey's loaf and started chewing it, without seeming to know she was doing it. She closed her eyes.
"Shit," she said. "I have to go to bed."
"Go." Pouncey didn't look up from the paper. "Go. We'll talk after you've slept."
Chapter 24 The Muntjac was becalmed, tossing on the gentle swell in the restless, unsettled way that boats do when they're built for speed but making no headway. Its slack ropes and tackle jostled and banged against the masts. It didn't like standing still. Rain fuzzed the surface of the sea into a cloudy gray blur. Nobody spoke. A week had gone by since Quentin and Poppy came back from the Netherlands, bearing news of the coming magical apocalypse and the true nature of the keys.
The long, low-ceilinged cabin where they ate their meals was filled with the sound of drops drumming on the deck overhead, so that they would have had to practically yell at each other to be understood anyway. They were going to find the last key, definitely. They just weren't sure yet precisely how they were going to do it.
"Let's go over it again," Elliot said, raising his voice to be heard over the rain. "These things always work by rules. You just have to figure out what they are. You went through with Julia," he pointed at Quentin, "but you didn't take the key with you."
"No."
"Could it have fallen through before the door closed? Could it be in the grass on your parents' lawn?"
"No, impossible."
He was almost sure. No, he was sure. The grass was like a damn putting green. They would have seen it.
"But then you," he turned to Bingle, "you searched the room and found no key."
"No key."
"But just now, when you two," Quentin and Poppy, "went through to the Netherlands, that key remained behind, here on this side."
"Correct," Poppy said. "Don't tell me it's gone too."
"No, we have it."
"What happened to it when the door closed?" Quentin asked. "Did it stay hanging there in midair?"
"No, it fell on the deck when the door closed. Bingle heard it and picked it up."
The conversation stopped, and the drumming rain filled in the silence.
It was neither warm nor cold. The deck overhead was watertight, but the air was so wet that Quentin felt like he was soaked through anyway. Every surface was sticky. Everything wooden was swollen. His damn collarbone was swollen. There was a glum scraping as people shifted in their wooden chairs. Above his head, Quentin heard the footsteps of whatever poor bastard was standing watch on deck.
"Maybe there was some space in between," Quentin said. "One of those gaps between dimensions. Maybe it fell in there."
"I thought the Netherlands was the gap between dimensions," Poppy said.
It is, but there's a different gap, too, when a portal pulls apart. But we would have seen that. The muntjac groaned softly as it swayed in place. Quentin wished that Julia were here, but she was below with a fever that might or might not have been related to whatever else was going on with her. She'd been down ever since the fight for the last key. She lay on her bed with her eyes closed, but not sleeping, breathing quickly and shallowly. Quentin went down there a few times a day to read to her, or hold her hand, or make her drink water. She didn't seem to care much, but Quentin